Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 149, which is the second part of a three-part guest interview on paleo art in popular culture. Obviously, if you've not yet listened to part one, then that's the place to start. But this second part is absolutely fascinating, and in it you'll hear Vicky Cools talking all about dinosaurs in film and animation, but examining titles from within their original historical, scientific, and social contexts. As always, we've got multimedia that accompany this episode on our website, and likes, shares, and comments on social media are always appreciated. Feel free to get in touch anywhere, anyhow, with your episode requests for 2023. We wish you all a happy new year, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
So, is it fair to say that Jurassic Park kind of set the popular image for dinosaurs back in 1993? Because I think for the last 30 years or so, when people think of dinosaurs, they think of the Jurassic Park dinosaurs, because that movie was, of course, a blockbuster. It was the first time that the CGI had been used to display these animals as vibrant, dynamic, active, intelligent animals.
Very much so. And I think the use of the CGI, it was the first time we had the finance as well as the technical ability, if you like, the computer ability to do that. So it was the first time really that the human-dinosaur interaction looked vaguely believable. We'd seen it in the past with Harryhausen and Willis O'Brien, but really they were limited in what they could do with the stop frame. But with Jurassic Park, there was a strong story. It wasn't exactly as the book, but it was a strong, there were strong ideas in that. And the interaction between the dinosaurs and between the dinosaurs and people was more or less seamless in terms of the cinematic side of it. And yes, and I think that people saw that. They hadn't seen anything like it before. And there is a sense that the public invest in their ideas of dinosaurs.
I was going to come on to that because I just said a moment ago, for the last 30 years or so, people think of Jurassic Park dinosaurs. But of course, I think before that, and I think maybe in a lot of people's minds, actually, dinosaurs are still those scaly, lumbering reptiles, you know, like the insult of dinosaur as this, you know, this ancient relic that should be, you know, ushered away.
Yes, and if you think about even the stop frame animation, I mean, something really basic with stop frame, if you're going to photograph the animal or the model, in each time you move it very slightly, each time you do that, the model has to be able to stand on its own. So what you couldn't do was have it, for example, running fast, because you couldn't get those intermediate frames because of the practicalities of photographing stop frame. So it was either stop frame or it was cartoon, effectively. But to see these dinosaurs in a story, interacting with people, looking like real animals, was a completely new experience for people. And I think the public sort of invested in that as the idea of that's what dinosaurs are.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a turning point in pop culture for dinosaurs, because, like you say, that's the point where you start to, you know, they're no longer just these abstract, well, not abstract ideas, but they're no longer just the displays in the museum. They're active animals, you know, just like seeing an elephant or a lion. That's how Spielberg portrayed them.
Yes, and the fact that they were fast-moving, the velociraptors in particular, the speed of movement, the cooperation, sense of a speed of thinking was completely new, but more so with them, I think, than the T-Rex, although the T-Rex tried to chase the Jeep.
This is where the T-Rex, that scene where it chases the Jeep, it certainly causes a bit of discussion amongst paleontologists, certainly since that scene aired. We now know that T-Rex was probably not that fast at all. And I think they kind of allude to that in the film where I think Ian Malcolm's character knocks the Jeep out of gear. So that's why it slows down so the T-Rex can catch up. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, back in the time, the paleontologists of the day were telling the animators, the people behind the film, that T-Rex could run like 30 miles an hour or something and could chase down the car. And the animators were having none of it.
Exactly. And what was happening was the advisors were saying, yes, we think it could run at that sort of speed. But animators are so used to making things look right. And if it looks wrong, it looks wrong immediately, even if you don't know why it looks wrong. And discussing this with somebody who knew some of the animators, they had taken this on board and said, OK, we can have the T-Rex running at that speed. As soon as they tried to animate it at that speed, it looked wrong. Intuitively, instinctively, it looked wrong. The animators said, no, we can only take it at this speed, which was ultimately found to be about approximately the speed that the later work on T-Rex's velocity, if you like,
I think was. That's amazing that you have these animators who, you know, they're not paleontologists, they don't really know about the animal, but the fact that they know about how to make these things move and work, it's the, you know, they have that kind of intuitiveness for anatomy, perhaps. Is that a way?
Yes. Yeah. Now, there's another lovely example of that. If you're familiar with Walt Disney's Fantasia, with the Rite of Spring sequence in that, which I'm sure many of you are, but the same thing was happening with the animation there. Those animators, they were trying to get input from paleontologists. They had Roy Chapman Andrews and Barnum Brown nominally advising them. It's arguable how much input they did actually have. But the interesting thing that happened there, and it's a sort of little aside, if you like, but at the time, T-Rex was still thought to take what we call the kangaroo pose.
This was a tripod.
The tripod, you know, sitting upright on its tail. And it starts, it looks like that when you first see the T-Rex, when it's first revealed in the thunderstorm. The T-Rex is then going to chase the other dinosaurs. As soon as the T-Rex starts to move and run, the animators brought the head down, the body horizontal, and the tail up. So it looked and moved like the portrayal of T-Rex that we now know is the one in that stance. But they did it instinctively. They could not make that T-Rex move in that original pose. So affecting that sequence, which rather comes out of that sequence, is another interesting comparison, because as we know, it was Robert Barker who came up with the whole concept of the dinosaur renaissance and the idea that they were fast, possibly hot-blooded, possibly a bit more quick-thinking, and so on, which was 30-odd years after that film was animated. But if you look at the chase sequence, when the dinosaurs are running away from the T-Rex, it's quite fast cut. So you're cutting between different dinosaurs. One of them stumbles and falls, which is quite startling. But in the background are three small bipedal dinosaurs running bipedally away from the T-Rex. And if you look at them, and you can freeze frame it on a DVD or whatever, those of you familiar with Barker's famous drawing that was the frontispiece to Ostrom's famous paper that is of the running Deinonychus? The running Deinonychus. They are effectively identical animals. So there was a case, again, of these animators working in the Disney studio needing to make these dinosaurs run. We'd seen these dinosaurs in the background in an earlier sequence, but to make them run, they made them run in the same way that the paleontologists worked out 30 years later.
Gosh, that's quite amazing. Like, 30 years worth of science to get to the point where the animators already knew, because again they were following the fundamental sort of physics of locomotion. I think we should be listening to the animators more often. I mean there are similar stories, I think, with walking with dinosaurs, aren't there, where they were using sort of I think they were using the props, and they worked out a particular way. I think it was sauropods. They were using the prop heads, and they realised the best way that these animals could actually strip vegetation, well, could eat vegetation, was to strip it using their teeth. And I think, again, it's that whole idea that sort of the filmmakers, the visual effects, the animators, they're all coming together to get, you know, how do these things fundamentally work?
And as you say, it is based on, if you like, from animators with movement, they understand biomechanics. They know how different animals moved and their different weight and ratio and so on. And I think that's something that I've heard that from people I've talked to in animation in other examples. But certainly with the dinosaurs, that was very much the case, that the animators quite often were ahead. And I'll bring in here one of my favourite dinosaur animations is, of course, Gertie the Dinosaur, which was a famous cartoon, not as well known as Fantasia, but was a cartoon made in 1914 by the animator Winsor McCay, who decided for various reasons that he was fascinated by the Brontosaurus and the AMNH, as it was then. And he had become interested in animation when it didn't really exist. We're not that far after the invention of cinema. And he was an illustrator, a newspaper illustrator. He was a very, very good, talented artist. And he had become fascinated when his son came home from school with some flip books, which I think you're familiar with, where you flip the pages and make a thing look like it's
many
moving.
Of you persons have done little doodles on their textbook or something.
Something like that, but you can have these. And he wanted to do this. So he started to experiment with animation, and he did a couple. And he also was making a bit of money by appearing in vaudeville, the sort of stage variety. And what he would do is project his animation onto a screen. He then hit upon the idea of doing this dinosaur. So he spent some time in the AMNH looking at and studying the Brontosaurus, and he came up with this cartoon of Gertie the Dinosaur. And the idea was he was on the stage dressed like a circus ringmaster. The cartoon would be projected, but he had drawn it in such a way that he could make it look like he was interacting with her, definitely a female. But what was fascinating about that animation, 1914, one of the first ever, it was certainly the first animation to set an animal in a landscape, and he didn't have cell animation then. He invented most of the techniques himself because they hadn't been thought of. And a lot of those techniques are still used in animation today, which is another fascinating long story. But what I found interesting about this is this cartoon lasts about 7 minutes, and you can see this dinosaur moving, interacting, and so on. And if you look at that cartoon, you're surprised at how good the biomechanics are of the movement. The walk cycle is right, the sense of weight. There are bits that are wrong because he had no models, but given how early that was and how much earlier than even something like Fantasia, that's another case of an animator just looking at it and thinking, is this right? There's a scene where you see her breathing, and he was timing his own breathing but realised he had to slow it down because she was supposed to be a big animal. And I think it's a phenomenal piece of animation, but it's, again, surprises people today looking at it from the biomechanics angle as to how accurate it actually was.
So that's the thing. I think people have they can see dodgy animation. They know it when they see it, and they know when something's not quite right. So I think we've all seen maybe some, you know, old documentaries, perhaps with questionable CGI, and you think, okay, maybe the rendering is not perhaps the best it could be, but the way it's moving is odd, and you know, you don't need to be a paleontologist to know that.
And that's instinctive.
So coming back to Jurassic Park and how it kind of set the popular image of dinosaurs for a lot of people today, that's of course caused a bit of controversy now, because see, we now know that dinosaurs were, you know, many of them were heavily feathered. Original Jurassic Park back in 1993 did not have the feathered dinosaurs. They were still scaly, even if they were active and intelligent. And I think that's caused a lot of debate online, certainly on Twitter, where you have people complaining now that dinosaurs have gone woke.
Yes.
Can you take us through like what's going on there?
There's several things. Firstly, I have heard even not that long ago, people on radio I was listening to talking about, oh, you know, dinosaurs have feathers. Oh, that means they weren't very scary. They would like, T-Rex would be like a big chicken. Now, it was almost as if you'd taken away that scary angle. And personally, I have been on the beach at Lyme Regis and nearly lost my fish and chips to a seagull, and I nearly lost my ice cream to a seagull. Or if you come face to face with an ostrich or a cassowary, I think they're quite scary.
I was going to say, is this a shoebill as well? If you look at those on Google, you'll see, actually, you know what, that's a bird you wouldn't want to, want to come across.
So there's this perception that by giving them feathers, without thinking it through, by giving them feathers, that takes away the scary angle. I think the other thing that's caused the recent uproar, this whole sort of lashback against what they're calling the expression woke, was, for example, in Prehistoric Planet, we saw the male T-Rex as a caring parent. So they saw the sequence in that show was the male T-Rex taking his young across to the island. And the idea being that, well, we think T-Rex should be scary. You know, they've taken our monsters away, which then leads you down the route of it's a dreadful word, but the monsterization of dinosaurs. Mm. But the idea of something like T-Rex, which had always been portrayed as the, to some extent, the villain, not necessarily, but to some extent the villain. So the T-Rex rescues them at the end of Jurassic Park and takes on the velociraptors and so on. But that idea of it being this big, fierce predator, there is this reluctance to admit that actually they might have had parental care and so on. Even though we did see that, didn't we, in one of the Jurassic Park sequels, where
in the Lost World,
in the Lost World, where they rescue the baby and mend its broken leg and so on. But
I should mention the humans mend its broken leg, not the T-Rex.
Not the T-Rex. It's the T-Rex, yes. But the T-Rex mother is not impressed and so on. But
they come to recover their chick.
That's right. They come after it. And it seems to me a sort of claiming of the dinosaur as a beloved monster, which I think ties in with the reluctance to think of them as being feathered and so on.
And do you think, like, is it a question that T-Rex has been, is on a bit of a pedestal because it's that iconic dinosaur? It's one of the iconic dinosaurs, T-Rex, Triceratops, Brontosaurus. I think Velociraptor perhaps nowadays, but only because of Jurassic Park, really. Before that, I don't think it was well known.
No, and I think there's an interesting thing around T-Rex, and I do think some of this comes out of Disney's Fantasia. Mm. And I'll talk a little bit about that because it's really interesting. Again, from what I've been doing, looking at the sort of cultural background, it was known as a big carnivorous dinosaur, but there were others around as well, so it wasn't the only one. If you watch the film Fantasia has 8 separate sequences, completely discrete sequences, where animation is set to classical music. Some of it's abstract, some of it's stories. Some of you might remember the dancing hippos or the Chinese mushrooms. At the start of every sequence, the master of ceremonies stands and explains what's going to happen. At the beginning of this sequence with the dinosaurs, it's set to the music of the Rite of Spring. But the master of ceremonies talks about the dinosaurs, and he talks about the fact that some of them were evil. Among the dinosaurs, he uses the phrase, were gangsters and bullies.
I was going to say, I've never really understood where that came from. Like, why gangsters? Like, I can understand maybe bullies, but gangsters?
Well, if you think about that period, we're in the 1930s when they were animating. The gangster culture had come out of the American Prohibition. So you have to basically get back into American history. So we had Prohibition, and Prohibition drove the whole buying and consuming of alcohol underground, and it was controlled by a gangster culture, subculture. And then you started to get the films that were made about gangsters. And some of these early gangster films, before the full censorship system kicked in, were actually quite violent and so on. And at that point, a gangster and we know the name of somebody like Al Capone, but the gangsters were seen as these really bad guys. It was organized gang crime. They apparently had no qualms about knocking out their rivals and so on. And the expression, the fact that the master of ceremonies in the film uses that expression, implies that the audience knows what he means.
So it's kind of using sort of the current events, the current affairs of the time, to help, you know, again, make these animals relatable.
Yes, exactly.
So I think
that.
Most people at the time probably would be aware of sort of things like the mob wars between the rival gangs, and things like the Valentine's Day Massacre and whatnot.
And they would have seen the films, which obviously were fictitious, but there's a nice example. When you first see the T-Rex in Fantasia, it's got this slightly sinister grin. So it's showing its teeth, but it's got this sinister slight, it's not a smirk, it is more of a grin. And there's a really nice film, which I've got the still, which I used to compare, and that slight sort of sinister grin that you got with the gangsters when they were relating to, they're about to do something, you know, they're waving a machine gun around or something. And I think that the fact that the expression used in that introduction was bullies and gangsters was relating what they were going to see in this T-Rex character to characters that the audience already knew about, which was, as you said, the mob.
I mean, I would never have thought that, yeah, the T-Rex and sort of the mobs of Prohibition would have been linked. But so I think, yeah, so that kind of sets the idea of T-Rex as the big bad for years, because obviously Fantasia came out in, what was it,
1940 it was released, and it has appeared on and off occasionally ever since, and it's obviously available now on digital media. But I have talked to grown paleontologists who are practicing now who were terrified. Because if you think about being in a cinema, you're seeing these in colour for the first time. This very, very dramatic, uncomfortable music. Stravinsky's music is not easy. So it wasn't like when they used Beethoven's Pastoral for another sequence. And it really did frighten people, children particularly. And I think there was that memory of that, which was carried on through. And then later on, if the film was being shown again, there are people who weren't children in the 1940s, but they were then taken to see the film in a cinema and were scared by this, the way the animators portrayed the T-Rex when it first appears, silhouetted by lightning in a thunderstorm.
And doesn't it have like glowing eyes as
it
well?
It has glowing red eyes, and it, this grin I've talked about reveals a sort of dark red mouth. Why it had glowing red eyes, I mean, T-Rex obviously doesn't, but that was, again, that was a very clear device that the animators were using to frighten. It's to instill that emotion in the audience.
And it, again, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen this, I'm giving you a moment now to skip about 15 seconds into the, well, or maybe a minute into the future. But this is one show where the T-Rex, you know, it wins because it eats the protagonist, as it were, the Stegosaurus, which is defending all the other dinosaurs. So is this something quite new? I mean, I think most people think of on-screen deaths for characters. Bambi comes up there in like Lion King, but this is 1940, you're saying, and
It's 1940, and it breaks a fundamental sort of rule, if you like, or convention of story, because you think of if you remember the sequence, the T-Rex appears, the dinosaurs all try and run away, including the Stegosaurus, Triceratops and so on. The Stegosaurus then turns and faces the T-Rex, and they have the infamous fight. Now, at that point, the Stegosaurus is taking on the role of hero because it's going to fight the villain. T-Rex is clearly the villain, the antagonist, and it's giving time for the others to get away. Now, in conventional story, however bad it looks, the hero wins. And in Fantasia, the hero dies. The T-Rex wins. And the actual last shot you see of that sequence is the Stegosaurus on the ground, dying. You see its eyes, and it closes its eyes. And then you see the T-Rex start to bend over because the T-Rex is going to eat it. So if you're a 7-year-old
So that'd be quite something for your sensibility, like the sensibilities of the time. That would have been quite scary for them. Yes. Let alone, like, you know, for the kids today. Like back then, that must have been.
So it was this sense of being breaking the rule of story, which was fascinating, because stories do have a fairly conventional structure, whether you go back thousands of years in mythology or film that's come out this week, there is that standard sort of convention, and it broke that. And I think that added to the T-Rex broke the rules, if you like, by killing and starting to eat the Stegosaurus.
Quite fast, yeah. It's quite something to see how all these different sort of influences come into effect the portrayals, because I think in Fantasia, that's also true of the end of that cartoon section with the dinosaurs, where it talks about how dinosaurs may have gone extinct.
Now, the end of that sequence is showing, again, some of you might be familiar with it, all the dinosaurs trekking across the desert in the heat under a blazing sun, dying of thirst, trying to get water out of the ground, sucking up mud pools and so on, in a lot of dust. And the question became, why did they show it like this? One of my areas of research has to be what was known of the science at the time. What were the best explanations? And there was no explanation that was consistent about why the dinosaurs went extinct. They knew they were extinct, but they didn't know why. And there were lots of conflicting theories. One was that it was the cold. One was that the mammals had eaten all the dinosaur eggs and so on. I could list several of them. They chose to show it as being heat and drought. And so the question was why. Now, in America at the time, there was a hugely influential event which affected the whole nation. And that event was the Dust Bowl. It became known as the Dust Bowl. That was in the mid-1930s, was a huge ecological disaster. Farmers were trying to grow wheat and raise cattle in the Midwest. The Midwest had been given out as cheap land to people, and there was a huge demand for wheat after World War I. And so it looked like it makes sense for them to go and farm there. The problem was they were farming land that had been held together by native grass. They were taking up this grass and farming it. The grass had been holding, if you like, the topsoil in place. It was a very dry time. What had actually happened was that the combination of drought, and you do get a lot of strong wind there, basically just stripped the topsoil away and created huge dust storms and completely destroyed the living of all these farmers. Totally. So dust storms were covering everything. Cattle were dying, farms were being buried in dust and so on. I mean, one of these dust clouds was so big and powerful that it actually got as far as the East Coast and the metropolis on the East Coast. Now, that was something that became very well known. The government employed photographers. There's a famous photographer called Dorothea Lange, some of you might have heard of. So they were commissioned to take photographs of these events and of the people. These people became migrants. And where most of them went was California. And so all these people had no reserves. They were upping sticks and taking their truck and their family and just going to California, desperate to find work. So you were in a situation where millions were flooding California. The Disney studios were in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles itself had problems with what the native population in Los Angeles were seeing as immigrants, people turning up, desperately wanting work. There wasn't any. And so this became two areas. One was the actual knowledge of this as a huge disaster that was publicized all over America, mostly by these photographs. And the other was California in particular being affected by this influx of people.
So they had a front row seat to this American refugee crisis.
It was very much a refugee crisis. Again, the introduction to, I'm really surprised that nobody had picked this up when I've been doing my sort of literature review and sort of background research. But in the introduction that I mentioned earlier, the Master of Ceremonies uses the phrase the dinosaurs went extinct, they marched across a gigantic dust bowl. And he uses that expression in the introduction. So he, again, or the studio, was assuming that the audience knew what he was talking about.
I imagine that they probably, like, the amount of people that had been affected by this, this would have loomed large in American, the American psyche.
And it still was to some extent. I mean, it was quite a while before it had sort of calmed down. They changed farming practice and so on. So by the late 1930s, this was a huge issue. It was a huge issue nationally because of the disaster, and it was a huge issue in California because of the influx of refugees.
So it seems that in these areas where we don't know, that it's a common thing for the animators, the filmmakers, the artists to insert perhaps things from their present sort of pop culture. And doesn't this take us back to the original sort of division between Cope and Marsh, where Marsh was arguing that, you know, if we get, like, where we don't know, if we get it wrong, that can impact the public's perceptions for years to come, for decades. And certainly with the Dust Bowl sequence in Fantasia, I think that was, a lot of people thought that was based on science, when yes. In reality, it was, they were just making it up, really. They were just taking something that they knew people at the time would know about, or at least resonate with, perhaps, and try and make it perhaps more understandable to audiences, rather than actually, you know, basing it on any scientific knowledge.
Yes, and I think that's, how much of that is actually conscious is another big debate, of course, because the animators and the production designers and Disney himself, well, Disney was very hands-on on this whole film, were going to make these decisions. So they're going to think, well, what could have been an explanation? And perhaps then thinking, well, we know that a situation like the Dust Bowl causes complete horrendous circumstances. And I'm sure a lot of farmers and their families lost their lives because of just the circumstances. And as you say, they might well have found the fact that that was something that the audience would resonate with, in the same way I use the example of the gangsters. And in both those examples, this, to some extent, clearly is me thinking around the cultural influences, but the fact that in that introduction to the sequence, they use the phrase bullies and gangsters, and they use the phrase gigantic dust bowl. So they're referring to an event that they assume their audience is very familiar with. And I think that's why they chose to show it like that.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.